Good morning. The last case on the calendar is Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs versus the City of Fort Lauderdale. We have counsel for the appellants, Kirsten Anderson, and for the appellee, Michael Burke. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Burke, you're muted for a second.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
The panel has decided that we would like to give you both additional time to argue. And so instead of 15 minutes, we're going to allow each side to have 20 minutes. Ms. Anderson, how would you like to divide that time for yourself?
I would like to divide it by having 15 minutes up front and then 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Kirsten Anderson, and I represent the plaintiffs' appellants, Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, along with four individual members of the group. This court's prior panel decision in 2018 held that Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs is engaged in expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment when it holds weekly demonstrations in a downtown city park to share food with all who are present to communicate their political message that food is a human right. At issue today is the constitutionality of the city's regulations that the city applied to Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs to shut down one of its demonstrations and cite and arrest individuals sharing food under its banner during three separate demonstrations.
Ms. Anderson, may I ask you a question? You concede that obviously the ordinance was repealed and that there's currently a new ordinance, 1744. Do you have any constitutional challenges to the new ordinance?
The new ordinance was not at issue in this case. Our challenge remains to the park rule, which continues to ban outdoor food sharing as a social service in all city parks.
So your argument is now going to be just based on the park rule 2.2?
That's correct, because the park rule is what creates a blanket ban in all city parks, regardless of the new ordinance that the city has adopted.
I'm confused. I'm sorry, go ahead. Okay.
Well, I guess I am confused as well, because that the park rule hasn't been enforced since 1999. So what's the future harm relating to that park rule?
That's not correct, Your Honor. The park rule, in fact, was enforced against members of Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs in 2014. There are arrest affidavits specifically in the record that state, for example, Lauren Wright on November 7th, 2014, was found to be in violation of Park Rule 2.2. She was asked to stop serving food, but continued serving. That's at docket 49-3 at 2. And in the affidavits of the individually named plaintiffs, they all state that she was a regular member of the Food Not Bombs group, and she was arrested when they were present. And then there were two other occasions where the park rule was at issue. There's a juvenile probable cause affidavit in the record at 49-3 at 5 that also states he was found to be in violation of Park Rule 2.2. And there was another arrest affidavit at 49-4 at 5 and 6 where David Rosenthal was found to be in violation of Park Rule 2.2. And these all occurred at food sharings by Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs. In addition to our claim for injunctive and declaratory relief, we also have a claim for damages as to the ordinance that was repealed. And so our claim as it relates
to— So your position, if I have it right, is that even if the application for injunctive relief regarding the ordinance is moot, we still have to address the constitutionality of the ordinance in order to come to grips with the damage claim. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Why isn't it moot, though, at least to the extent you're seeking prospective injunctive relief regarding the ordinance?
The issue here is the city's use of its legislation, which includes the park rule, to ban food sharing outdoors as a social service in city parks. The city has not unambiguously terminated its policy of doing so. When it repealed certain provisions of the ordinance, it left in place the park rule, which is a complete ban in all city parks. And so the core case or controversy remains in this case.
No, I'm simply asking, why would you be entitled to an injunctive relief regarding the ordinance?
Regarding
you might be entitled to it regarding the park rule, and you might be entitled to a declaration as to that, but why would you be entitled to prospective injunctive relief on an ordinance that the city has already repealed?
We wouldn't specifically be entitled to injunctive relief as it relates to the repealed provisions of the ordinance.
Okay, but, that's all I was asking.
Okay.
So you accept that the application for injunctive relief is moot with respect to prospective relief concerning the ordinance itself?
Yeah, concerning ordinance C-14-42.
Right, the ordinance that had all of these different places where you had to go to get approval and the $6,000 thing, all of that has been mooted out for purposes of injunctive relief. I just want to get on to what's in dispute.
Sure, sure. Yes, it appears that the city is no longer attempting to require a zoning permit for temporary use of city parks, which is—
okay, so we're not looking at an injunction with respect to the ordinance.
That's why we're just trying to understand where we are at this moment in time.
That's right.
And so that's why I asked that question to begin with. Are we really just addressing the park rule at this point?
We're addressing the park rule as it relates to our claim for prospective injunctive relief, but the ordinance C-14-42, all of the plaintiffs have claims for damages. And contrary to the city's unsupported allegations by council, both the ordinance and the park rule were applied to the plaintiffs in November of 2014, when the city was actively enforcing it against Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs.
Having gotten over this justiciability question, let me ask you first question, very interesting question that raised here. It's relevant for purposes of the unincorporated organization, not the individuals. But for purposes of 1983, who or what is a person? Is an unincorporated organization that is not a union a person? The reason I raise the question is it's raised its head in this case. If indeed that's right, it will work a profound impact on 1983 cases by hundreds of unincorporated organizations, local NACPs, local civil rights, ACLUs, et cetera. But how do you argue that an unincorporated organization is a person that's able to sue and be sued under 1983?
I think the easiest response is to just go back to this court's, to the Supreme Court's decision in Monell, where the court looked at the term person and to decide whether person extends both to natural and legal persons. And the court decided, yes, that's correct. In that case, the court was looking at the legal entity of a municipal corporation and whether or not, or they could sue or be sued.
There you did have a corporation. The reason I raise it is we've got a 10th Circuit case out there that suggests that an unincorporated association is not a person for the purposes of 1983, and they examined the legislative history and I suppose the understanding at common law way back in the 1870s when the statute was passed, and this real indication, at least as the common law, that unincorporated associations like partnerships couldn't sue or be sued at common law. Of course, you have a Supreme Court opinion saying something quite different with regard to an unincorporated labor union. But at common law, could an unincorporated association sue or be sued when they passed the Civil Rights Act, the first iteration of 1983?
they could not, neither could corporations, but both have been recognized as legal entities that can sue and be sued. And what we're really talking about with an unincorporated association is a group of persons, a group of natural persons who are associated.
So there's no question the natural persons can sue or be sued. I'm only asking about the organization, Food Not Bombs.
One of the things that the district court actually ruled in plaintiff's favor on this issue and collected cases and found persuasive a Southern District case, the Gay Straight Alliance case. And one of the things that the court in that case did was recognize that and said that the 10th Circuit's decision had failed to recognize that the Section 1983 is actually the Ku Klux Klan Act. And so one of the purposes was to be able to sue as a person the Klan members who were wreaking terror. And that's someone who can be sued. And there's sort of this mirroring logic that if you're using the term person as an individual who can be sued, that should have the same meaning for a person who can sue. And there's been a long history of both an implicit and explicit recognition of unincorporated associations as entities that can bring suit under Section 1983. For example, the former Fifth Circuit in the Familias Unidas case that we cited to in our papers, that you know the plaintiff in that case was an unincorporated association. There's a long history of NAACP cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. We respectfully suggest that this 10th Circuit case is an outlier, as the district court correctly observed, and that the 11th Circuit should not follow the reasoning in that case and instead recognize that unincorporated associations do have are.
Let's assume, for the purpose of my question, it's clear that the individuals can sue under 1983, and let's just assume that an unincorporated person, an incorporated association can as well. I have sort of a general merits question for you. Suppose the city of Fort Lauderdale had said, we're banning the distribution of all social services in our parks, whether it's feeding the hungry, clothing the needy, providing shelter for those without homes, providing hygiene or medical care. We just don't want that in the park. And so we're keeping that out of the parks completely. Clear ban. Could they do that? As opposed to what they did here.
They could regulate, they can absolutely regulate the park as long as that interest is unrelated to the suppression of expression. And
that if there was a flat out ban on the distribution of all social services in all of the parks in the city, they could constitutionally do that so long as they could show that they're applying this even-handedly across the board for all social services, food, shelter, hygiene, medical care, the whole kit and caboodle. They could do that if they wanted to, couldn't they?
Well, that's actually what the park rule says. I think the issue here is singling out sharing food as a social service.
The park rule says something a little different. It says parks shall be used for recreation and relaxation, ornament, light, and air for the general public. Parks shall not be used for business or social purposes unless authorized pursuant to a written agreement with the city. So it suggests that at least under some circumstances, perhaps the city has the power to authorize it. Now, it may be that as a licensing regulation, this fails because it's utterly unbridled, et cetera. But I'm asking a different question. Suppose the city of Fort Lauderdale had simply said, no social services shall be distributed in any of our parks. Could they constitutionally do that? Wouldn't that be content neutral?
I think the issue here is the provision of food as a social service, which is what the city has said that you can, I mean, having food in a public park is something that doesn't interfere with the normal use of the park. It's a regular use of the park. People have picnics, people have-
Food as a social service, where we're not talking about a family of four sitting at a picnic table and having lunch in a nice sunny afternoon on a Sunday. I'm talking about how they define a social service. A service designed and intended to feed large numbers of hungry people. All I'm asking is, I'm not saying that's what they did here. Mm-hmm. Could they ban all social services, including but not limited to dispensing food to the hungry in the parks?
I don't believe so as it relates to food, and here's why. First of all, there is no minimum number of members of the public that the ordinance applies to. This is not a large group events ordinance. It applies to sharing food with as few as one or two members of the public. The other reason is that you have to look at the purpose for which food is being provided, and it gives too much discretion to city officials to pick and choose what is allowed and what isn't as it relates to sharing food in a public space.
Right, the question was banning giving out food as a social service completely. And so the question is, if there's a rational basis for the city making that determination, why would that not be constitutional?
I don't think that that would be narrowly tailored, because it does implicate speech interests. You have to look at the purpose for which food is being provided to determine whether or not food sharing is allowed.
But how is it? How is it not content neutral? Because they're not looking at the speech. They're saying there is no food service that is being allowed if it's being provided for any social service. It doesn't matter if it's a church, if it's a temple, if it's a an organization that believes in promoting veganism, it's irrelevant. It applies across the board. Why can the city not make that determination?
Well, in our case, we have a situation where our clients have-
But I'm not asking about your case. I'm asking a general hypothetical question.
Well, the hypothetical question about social service as it relates to a group that's sharing food for a political purpose, the city has classified that as a social service. But the issue is that when you're saying that you are banning food sharing as a social service, the city has to make these discretionary determinations about why someone's sharing food and isn't. And this court's prior panel decision specifically talked about how sharing food in this context, it like communicates message and is expressive and has been expressive for thousands.
See, I thought, Ms. Hume, what you would say to me is, that's an interesting question, Marcus, but that's not the question we have, because in this case, there is an ordinance that existed and we're suing for damages with regard to the ordinance. And there is a park rule that existed. So they didn't create a flat all-out ban on all social services, certainly not for food. And so that may be an interesting question, but that doesn't illuminate what's happening here. Have I missed something?
Well, I think that what's happening here is whether or not you can actually get permission, I think is a big question, either under the ordinance or the park rule, and whether or not it is a blanket ban or not.
Your position is what they did here was tantamount to a flat ban, even though if you read the ordinance and the park rule together, it didn't literally ban it.
That's correct. But I will say that the ordinance, all parks are zoned P. It's a prohibited use. You absolutely could not have gotten a zoning permit. The only park where you theoretically could have gotten one is Stranahan Park. And I see my time has expired, but the last point I wanted to make just related to this is that a content neutral ban on sharing food, we could just look at the Orlando First Vagabonds Church which was the 11th Circuit, and en banc, where you didn't look at the purpose of sharing food. They just restricted large groups over 25. That would be a content neutral restriction. And that certainly was upheld as being a reasonable restriction on
speech. Are you suggesting that the first vagabond case, the reason that it's distinguishable is because of the numerical number in the ordinance?
It's the numerical number, and also that there was no inquiry into the purpose. It was all events that involved food, regardless of the reason why. It's similar to the Thomas versus City of Chicago Park District case, where in a park they authorized permits for assemblies greater than 50 people. It's about regulation of park use and the size. Here, this isn't even about large groups. It's as few as one person in the city.
May I ask you a question? I know your time is up, but the city never created, my understanding of the record, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the city never created a fee scheme for the ordinance 1442 because it wasn't enforced long enough. Is it your argument that the ordinance is that provision, is it that it's an unconstitutional fee scheme? Is it ripe for our review if it was never enforced?
Yes, because it was enforced. They arrested people for not having a permit.
No, but I'm saying the fee scheme, because they never created a fee scheme. That's my understanding of the record.
Yeah, well, the reason the city suggests that is that the general fee is $6,000, but they're suggesting that they had discretion to adjust that downward depending on how the administrator feels. So there was a fee scheme in place. They were just suggesting that maybe it didn't have to be so high.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Council. Mr. Burke, you have 20 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning. Michael Burke on behalf of the Appalachia City of Fort Lauderdale. The city's position is that the district court properly applied this court's en banc decision in First Vagabond to the issues that it was tasked with dealing with on remand. The First Vagabond decision, which relies on Clark versus community for...
Can you tell us, Mr. Burke, I'm sorry to break your flow, but what's properly before us? What are the justiciable issues that are before us?
Good question. Before
we go to the merits, I'd like to know what you think we have to decide.
I think first the court has to decide whether the primary plaintiff here, Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, is a person who can bring claim under 42 USC section 1983. It calls itself an unincorporated association. The record is that it's not a legal entity of any kind in any state that I'm aware of. It has no formal membership, no formative documents, no elected leaders, no record of their members, no written proof of members, no bylaws. It in fact doesn't even call the people who participate in its events members. It calls them volunteers. It's difficult to discern what it is, if anything, but it's certainly not a person. And
even assuming arguendo that you were right about that, Mr. Burke, the individual plaintiffs certainly are persons under 1983. So we would have to face the issues anyway. But it's an interesting question that you've raised about whether an unincorporated association can sue or be sued under 1983. The Supreme Court told us in Alley that an unincorporated labor union could sue under 1983. That was a holding. They don't say much about it. It's in a footnote, but they sure say it, and they say it unambiguously. What's the difference?
Well, again, I would say a couple of things. First, as you say, there was no analysis in that decision, number one. Number two, and probably most importantly, unincorporated association is a broad term. and a labor union, which has a charter, formal membership, leaders, all of the things attendant to an actual organization of some sort, as you had in that case, is not here. And what you have here.
Of course, you know, but what's interesting about the Supreme Court opinion is there's no discussion about any limitations on their holding. They don't talk about the peculiar circumstances relating to the unions, the pervasive character of unions, none of that. They simply say in a footnote, a union has standing to sue under 1983 as a person. Literally speaking, it's really not a standing question. It's whether it states a claim as a person. But let's hold that issue aside. Would you have us hold for the first time that all unincorporated persons are unable to sue under 1983?
No, Your Honor.
That's an enormously significant ruling.
No, Your Honor, and I would not have, I don't urge that, but I do urge the court that when it looks at Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs and what the record is here, that it find that Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, whatever it is, does not meet the definition of a person. Your Honor, to continue on with your question, the ordinance here, and I think it's important to know that the city, there's two things, of course, that have been raised in the papers. One is the ordinance which amended a land development regulation of the city to effectively change the city's regulation as it relates to social service facilities. Social service facilities, it set forth regulations as to where they could locate social service facilities, and it created a social service facility that is called off-premises food distribution centers. And so that's where we come into a land development regulation as it relates to this provision of food at little or no cost at many locations, not just parks or otherwise, where they can be located and what is needed to do that. So you have a zoning regulation. Secondly, you have a park rule. And I think it's very important that the court note that the park rule is not adopted by ordinance. It is approved by the city commission, but it is not an ordinance. It's not a law. It is a rule. It doesn't have any mechanism of enforcement to it.
Let me ask you this question, if I can, yes. Mr. Burke. Obviously, we have to address the ordinance, at least with respect to the damages application. So we can't, but with respect to prospective injunctive relief, your colleague concedes that issue is moot. But it's still in front of us for purposes of damages. When you read together the ordinance and the park rule, is it the position of the city of Fort Lauderdale that you have attempted to ban completely all sharing of food as part of a social service? Is that what you've done? Or do you allow it at least under some circumstances in at least in Stranahan Park?
So, Your Honor, the zoning regulation allows for social services at numerous locations throughout the city, in various zoning districts.
When you say the ordinance, are you saying about the new ordinance? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, Your Honor, it would be the old ordinance. The new ordinance has eliminated this outdoor food distribution center from the definition of social services. And that's why it has mooted any prospective relief related to public feedings, because that has been removed from the social services ordinance of the city.
My question is clear. Let me just sort of come at it one more time. If I decided today that I wanted to distribute food as part of a political protest, where my claim was the government had misallocated its resources, it spent too much money for the Defense Department and not enough on feeding the hungry and the poor. And I said to the city, I want to proceed to demonstrate my message this way in your parks. Can I do that, or is there an absolute ban on that?
So there is a park rule that hasn't been enforced that does speak to that issue, Your Honor, as you pointed out earlier, with the exception that by agreement, businesses and social service use of parks can be arranged. For instance, during the COVID crisis, I mean, it's well known that city and county parks are used to provide social service vaccinations to the public at parks. So that is being done, and it can be done.
So you don't take the position that there's an absolute ban?
No, Your Honor, there's not an absolute ban. You are correct in how you described that earlier. It has an exception if under the park rule. Again, under the ordinance, doesn't exist at all. There's nothing about food sharing in the current social services ordinance of the city.
Now, which brings me to my next question. If you look at what the panel did on round one in this case, the panel ruled, and I'm quoting from their holding on page 1245 of the court's opinion, the panel said in the first iteration of Fort Lauderdale Food versus the City of Fort Lauderdale, quote, the nature of FNB's activity combined with the factual context and environment in which it was undertaken lead to the conclusion that FLFNB engaged in a form of protected expression. So they've already answered the first question, whether or not this falls on the near side of constitutional protection. They simply didn't get into the weeds, digging down into the second set of questions, which include whether or not these ordinances and park rules violate the First Amendment. Now, it looks to me like you've got to examine this under some form of intermediate scrutiny, because it looks to me, just speaking for myself, that the ordinance and the park rules are content neutral. They speak broadly to a variety of social services, not limited to food. So I want you to assume, for the purpose of my question, that we're in the realm of content neutrality and intermediate scrutiny. You would agree with that, would you not?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. That's what the district court applied, and I would agree with that.
Okay, so with regard to intermediate scrutiny, we ask whether the ordinance, regulation, or rule has been narrowly tailored to accomplish a substantial government interest not related to the suppression of any particular message or idea, and it must leave open ample alternative channels for communicating the particular message or information. Tell me why the ordinance and the park rule has been narrowly tailored.
Your Honor, it is narrowly
tailored. You would agree it would have to be narrowly tailored, right?
Under the intermediate scrutiny, yes, Your Honor, it would be. It would need to be narrowly tailored. I would start off by my answer by saying that the regulation itself does not seek to address any form of speech or expression. So by definition, when you're going into it, much like the Clark case that cited by this court in the Vagabond case that prohibited camping on the National Mall or Lafayette Park, you know, camping was not looked at as expressive activity. And so therefore, when you're developing a regulation that doesn't relate to expressive activity, you know, you certainly don't go into it with the same basis that you would for regulating expression and the standard that we're now applying. And so that's kind of the way the district court looked at this. And that is, when you look at this, it is only apparently in the case of Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, that they, because as you just quoted earlier from the first iteration of this court's decision, it is only when you combine all of these things that it does that it constitutes some form of protected expression. So what I would say, Your Honor, is that there are numerous places where they can engage in that activity. They could, if they had ever asked, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that under the park rule they asked to seek to enter into some agreement with the city because of their particular way of sharing food with the public and the expression that it involves, that could have been arranged and still protect the sanitation, the garbage removal, and all of the other things that we cite, all the other unpleasantries that we cite that led to this dispute in general.
About that, when I look at the park rule, it says parks shall not be used for business or social purposes unless authorized pursuant to a written agreement with the city. That's the beginning and the end of what it says. It provides no guidance to the city. It provides no rules of the game to the city. If this is a classic licensing scheme, it seems to repose utterly unbridled authority in the city. We don't know who the decision maker is. We don't know what considerations are relevant. We don't know how it would be exercised. How would this possibly pass a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction?
Well, Your Honor, again, there would have had to have been some attempt to apply it in some way. It's never been applied. And so by its very nature, what Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs does is you have to look at what they actually do. You have to have an as-applied challenge for them to bring the claim. It's providing food to people or clothing to people or medical care to people is not expressive activity. And that's what the district court says. It's not by its very nature expressive activity. And so it can only really be judged under an as applied challenge. So if you look at it facially, yeah, I mean, it doesn't attempt to regulate expression of any kind. And so, yeah, it doesn't have the requirement that people act in a certain time and that it be subject to an appeal. And it doesn't have all those provisions that you would have if a regulation.
It doesn't have any provisions.
It doesn't. It doesn't because.
The city to know when to grant authorization pursuant to a written contract and when not? What are the terms and conditions that a city might reasonably use in deciding whether to enter into an agreement with an organization? And again, we're not starting with a clean slate, as I said. We're starting with the law of this case is that it is expressive, constitutionally expressive First Amendment activity to propagate the message of food, not bombs, by serving the homeless food. The circuit has already told us that in round one. What terms and conditions is the city going to use in making that determination as applied to a particular group that says, I want to do this?
So, Your Honor, there is nothing in the record that I would be able to answer that question, except to say that for the last 22 years, it hasn't been applied. So, again, we can, what we're talking about here is truly how many angels can dance on that head of that pin, because it is something that is not been done. It is an argument that is made without any factual content.
Is it your view that because they didn't proceed under the park rule, they can't make an as-applied challenge at all to the park rule?
It's my view that number one, you can't even cite Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs. I mean, it's not an entity. Who would you cite? the plaintiffs who are in our, you asked about just disability, the plaintiffs that are in the case, they were never cited for the park rule or the ordinance. What I would say in direct answer to your question is that the issue is that they would have had to have sought something from the city, provided some explanation to the city for that to arise in an as-applied way. The only evidence in the record about any citation that has ever been issued during the three-week period of time that we're talking about, back in 2014, November of 2014, is that people received citations for violating the ordinance, and it mentioned in there the park. Well,
may I ask you a question? Because I do want to confirm this. I want to be very clear about this. So the record, if I went into the record right now, neither the organization, Food for Bombs, or Food Not Bombs, and none of the named plaintiffs were cited or given any kind of violation that required a payment of a fee.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's my understanding that Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs and none of the named individual plaintiffs were ever cited. Counsel during her argument indicated that some people received citations. They did for violating the ordinance. And in that citation, it mentioned the park rule. The park rule, if it were to be enforced.
Do you know if any of those individuals, and I understand that none of them are named plaintiffs or in this case right now, but do you know if any of those individuals had to pay any fees?
I do not know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And I don't believe
that. Let me ask you a slightly different question. Is Stranahan Park the only park where they could arguably make an application to distribute food as part of their political message?
Well, certainly under the ordinance, it would have been the only location, because Stranahan Park is not zoned park. Properties zoned park were excluded from social service facility use. You couldn't build a healthcare center in a park, for instance, or do this. The Stranahan Park was zoned it's in the city's downtown core, and it was zoned regional activity center, and it allowed as a conditional use in the regional activity center outdoor feeding distribution centers, which is what during that 3 week period of time this would have been. So they could have applied at Stranahan Park for that if they had chosen.
So that was the one park they could have at least sought an application. Let me ask you, I was much interested in the response you just gave. Are you saying in effect that this unincorporated association and the named plaintiffs don't have standing to challenge the park rule? That this is a question of justiciability?
Yes, Your Honor, I absolutely am saying that. They have never been cited with, and they wouldn't be cited with a violation of it. The way it's a rule. And so what happens is it's not an ordinance, it's not a law, it doesn't have any enforcement mechanism to it. So the way in which a park rule would be enforced is if you're violating a park rule, someone from the city would go up to you and say, you're violating that park rule, you need to stop. And if you don't stop and you keep doing it, then eventually they'd probably have to get a law enforcement officer and give you a trespass warning and say, if you won't stop violating the rule, we're going to have to ask you to leave the park. So what happened here, as I understand it, in the record on November 7th, a food distribution that Food Not Bombs was engaged in was interrupted by the police. And again, my understanding is that was pursuant to the ordinance. I understand that sometimes for citations for the ordinance, the officers have mentioned in those citations, which seek to enforce a municipal ordinance, the zoning code.
Let me ask the question.
Was violated. Mr. Burke.
Normally, when we speak of standing, justiciability for a live case or controversy, the first requirement is that there be an actual and immediate injury, not something that's hypothetical or conjectural. I understood them to claim, among other things, that they went ahead and tried to distribute food and propagate their message, and the city busted up the rally and arrested some of the people present, and that substantial costs were incurred in the course of that. Would that not give the organization and the individual standing?
Your Honor, individuals that were arrested for that?
No, I'm not talking about the individuals who were arrested.
Okay.
I'm talking about the organization that put on this message and the named plaintiffs who were members of the organization. Is it your position that the organization cannot establish any actual injury in fact?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, okay. the named organization, as we say, and you use the term members, there is no official membership. They in fact call them volunteers. So if an organization, something that's not a legal entity, invites volunteers.
So this is a different question about whether they can sue under 1983. I'm not asking you that question. Assume for the purposes of my question that this organization, unincorporated association, can raise a claim as a person that may sue under 1983. That's a debatable question. You say no, they can't. Let's hold that aside and assume for the purposes of my question that this association, in fact, can sue under 1983. Okay. Is it your view that this association has no injury in fact and has no standing to perfect this lawsuit?
No, Your Honor, I believe that they would have standing if in fact they had, they were a person, they were an entity.
Okay, so your argument is not justiciability, it's just they can't state the claim because they're not a person under 1983.
They have, my argument is there's no justiciability under the park rule. Under the ordinance, as I understand it, during the 3-week period that it was in effect, there is, as you say, and we're describing in your question, on November 7, a food distribution by Food Not Bombs was interrupted. And as you say, some folks who claim to be affiliated with that entity, if that's what it is, were given citations. I believe that under this court's law, under the 11th Circuit law, that would be sufficient for the organization to sue.
That is to say, have standing.
Yes.
But your basic position is they can't sue for a different reason, not because they weren't injured, but because they're not a person.
But for number one, for the ordinance of the park rule, they can't sue because it's never been applied to them. That's what I say there, not applied to them.
I have a question about the park rule, and I'm now confused about the status of this park. You said it was never zoned as a park, and it was never subject to the park rule. Rather, it was zoned as a regional activity center at this time that did allow feeding, and the violation was just the ordinance. Is that your position?
Almost. This I do believe this park, Stranahan Park, would have been subject to the park rule if the park rule was going to be enforced. All of the city's other parks have a zoning designation attached to the land that they're on of park.
I don't want to talk about other parks. I want to talk about this park. You're saying it wasn't zoned as a park. So how was it? Was it subject to the park rule or not? I guess.
Your Honor, I think it would be subject to the park rule if the park rule was going to be applied. It was a park, but the land it was on was zoned regional activity center, which provided under this 3-week ordinance the ability to, unlike other land that was zoned park, you could come in and you could seek a conditional use to have a social service facility on land zoned regional activity center.
Does that mean that you could have sought a permit to do that activity? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. That's correct.
Because it was zoned for that particular use.
That's correct. Well, it was zoned regional activity center, which allowed the use as a conditional use. The city's, again, this was a zoning regulation. The ordinance was a zoning regulation, and it regulated where social service facilities could locate, and it regulated their operation.
And normally zoning ordinances are rational review, are they not?
Yes, because they're, of course, not generally regulating expression. It's regulating, you know, conduct. It's regulating the activity that one engages in on the property.
But if it's regulating expressive conduct, which is what the first iteration of this case held, then it gets some First Amendment protection, and we've got to go to some kind of intermediate scrutiny. You do not dispute that, do you?
I do not, Your Honor, and that's what the district court
I mean, did. That's what we're left with because of what the panel held on round one.
That's correct.
let me ask you the same question I asked your colleague earlier. Could you simply ban all social services from being distributed in the park if you wanted to?
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe there'd be a rational basis for banning the provision of social services in the park.
But you have not done that.
Well, as you point out, the park rule, which hasn't been enforced in 22 years, does have the last phrase to it that Your Honor quoted. And so there is a potential exception.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you all.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson, you have 5 minutes remaining. Thank you.
Thank you. Before you begin, when you say damages, are you talking about compensatory damages or just nominal damages?
The demand was for compensatory damages.
And what is the compensatory damage claim? I mean, is it, somebody injured
No, it's related to non-economic harm. As it relates to the organization, there was some significant diversion of resources during the time that these ordinance and the park rule were being enforced against their demonstrations. And then also as it relates to the individual plaintiffs, we've pled emotional distress as it relates to
you've answered my question. It's not you're claiming compensatory damages, not just nominal damages.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And what I will say is that as it relates to the individual plaintiffs, there is no dispute that they were all present during the time when the police came, arrested members that they were associating with during this political protest. And on one occasion, the entire demonstration was shut down. The U.S. Supreme Court-
Were these individual plaintiffs, did they receive citations or were they required to pay any kind of fines?
They did not. Organization itself did put together a bail fund when they were having to bail out.
I'm talking about the individual plaintiffs. Did they come out of pocket any money?
No out of pocket expenses, that's correct.
Okay. Well, even without fines, they weren't given a citation.
They were not given a citation, but as it relates to counsel's argument that means that they didn't have standing, that's not the legal standard for standing. The question as it relates to the park rule for prospective injunctive relief is whether there's a credible threat of future prosecution. And then the standard as it relates to-
Let me stop you right there. Credible threat of future prosecution. We already know the ordinance is gone. So now we're talking about the park rule, right? And how is it a credible threat of future prosecution of park rule if you haven't even asked to have an exception and to have a, if you've never applied to work out anything with the city?
Well, that's, again, not the legal standard that the Supreme Court set forth in a long line of cases.
I'm not talking about standards. I'm talking about in fact. Tell me how that's a credible threat that you haven't asked to
for a permit
for because anything, not even a permit, as for can we go and do this with the city in agreement under the park rule?
Because without permission, it's banned. And
they're all banned unless you get permission, okay? And you've never asked for permission.
And there's no criteria, no standards under which permission could
I'm not saying you had to. I'm just trying to understand the facts.
That's so correct.
As we take the facts, this is a situation where the ordinance is gone and the park rule bans everything unless you get special permission.
That's correct. And one point I want to make.
You've not asked for special permission. You stipulate to that.
I would. That's correct,
Your Honor. Okay.
And what I will say is that the U.S. Supreme Court case in the Uzbabunam versus Przewski case that we filed as supplemental authority discussed a constitutional injury sufficient to, at a minimum, confer nominal damages. And in that case, it was an individual who was told that he had to leave and couldn't proselytize. And just that, that is a completed constitutional injury, being losing that opportunity to speak.
Okay. I have one more question here on the park rule. When they disrupted this group, they really were operating, I mean, it looks like to me, under that ordinance. I mean, they enforced the ordinance. They didn't come in and enforce the park rule. They came in and cited it for violation of an ordinance. They didn't, that disruption, those citations were for the ordinance.
The citations cited both the park rule and the ordinance. And
all right, where will we find the other citations in the record?
Sure. So this was the Lauren Wright citation at docket number 49-3 at 2. And then all of the affidavits of the individual plaintiffs all discussed that citation and that she was a regular member of the group and they were present when she was arrested on 11-7-2014. And it states that she was found to be in violation of Park Rule 2.2. She was asked to stop serving food, but continued serving. There are two other arrest affidavits in the record that are also discussed by the affidavits of the plaintiffs at 49-3 at 5 and 49-4 at 5 and 6 that all reference the Park Rule. And one other point I will make about the park rule is that when the City Commission adopted Ordinance C-14-42 in the legislative memo, it said one of the purposes of adopting these zoning regulations was to allow it to resume enforcement of Park Rule 2.2. It had previously been enjoined from doing so by a religious ministry, Love Thy Neighbor, in a Religious Freedom Restoration Act case in state court, the Abbott case. And so one of the reasons why the city then stopped after this flurry of arrest activity is that Arnold Abbott went back into court to enforce his injunction against the city. And then the city voluntarily declined to continue arresting while all these proceedings were taking place. So the other point about the park rule.
Hey, may I ask you a question though? Because I have the some of the affidavit, the declarations in front of me, and like the declaration of Haley Becker only references the ordinance. It makes no mention of the park rule. So I'm just kind of curious about that.
Well, I'll just point as it relates to Haley Becker at 40-25 at paragraph 12. She references that Lauren Wright was a Food Not Bombs member cited at their demonstration while she was present. And then we also separately have that arrest affidavit that references the park rule in the record. If it would be useful, I have all of the pinpoint sites of all the places where this is discussed. I could file something supplemental to the court to point this out, because this is really not factually correct, the city's assertion that it never enforced the park rule. And one thing I will say is that when the city decided to repeal these regulations in the zoning ordinance, the same city commission that's responsible for adopting park rules decided to leave park rule 2.2 in place.
I'm looking right now at the complaint affidavit. And was it against Lauren Nicole Wright? Is that who you're referring to?
That's correct.
Okay, well, in the citation, it only charges her, because obviously you have to be charged in the citation, and it only charges there with Sydney. It only mentions the city ordinance. So the charge is the city ordinance 47-18-31 and city ordinance 16-1, it says.
That's correct. But then if you look at the narrative.
Well, I understand what the affidavit says, but the charge, the citation, is only for the ordinance. It makes no mention of the rule.
That's correct, because the rule itself is not an independently arrestable offense. You can only get arrested if the city comes in and says.
But then again, the question becomes, where is the teeth? Because now that ordinance is no longer in place. So moving forward, what happens to the rule? The rule has no basis then. You can't be cited now.
That's not correct. What Mr. Burke said is that the police can come and tell you you have to stop and you have to leave. And if you don't, you can be arrested for trespassing and you can be given a trespass warning, which bans you from returning to the park in the future. Those are constitutional harms, both as it relates to the First Amendment, having to cease First Amendment protected activity, and having to leave a city park that you have a lawful liberty interest in being present in. So even if the park rule itself doesn't allow arresting under the city ordinance, it is allowed, because if you're in violation of the park rules, you can be ejected and trespassed from the park.
Ms. Hume, let me ask you a different question. To the extent that the organization and the individual named plaintiffs are suing the city for a violation of the First Amendment with respect to the park rule, you agree that you never sought the relief from the park rule. You never applied.
That's correct.
Can you perfect an as-applied challenge without ever having attempted to go to the city and getting a contract so that you could pursue your regime?
Yes, Your Honor, because the
tell park, me the basis.
The park rule is being applied to prohibit our clients' constitutionally protected demonstrations. And in Thornhill versus Alabama and Shuttlesworth, the Supreme Court has long held that when your protected activity is banned, that you can continue to engage in your protected demonstrations and challenge the validity of the permit scheme without first having to apply for and be denied a permit.
The issue I'm having with your argument is it seems to me we don't know if they would deny you a permit because you haven't sought one.
It is constitutionally impermissible to have a permit scheme where there's absolutely no basis for knowing whether there's a denial or a grant. There's no criteria. There's nothing under those circumstances.
It could be a church group. It could be a temple. It could be anyone who wants to distribute food to the homeless, and they would still have to go out and seek a permit if they want to have distribute food at that particular location at that park.
Right, and what the Supreme Court
for a recreational activity, social recreational activity.
Absolutely. And what the Supreme Court has said is that even when you can rightfully issue permits for such activity, that you can't do so in a way that leaves it up to the whim of the licensing official to grant or deny permits, because the risk of suppression of speech, of arbitrary enforcement, of picking and choosing who's allowed to be in a park and share food and who isn't is too great. And that's why the Supreme Court has.
Well, what if the thing was they said, well, you can distribute the food, but you have to distribute the food between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. On a Sunday.
In terms of just a regulation,
would that be permissible?
I mean, if it's a it, it it could potentially be a reasonable time, place, or manner restriction. And one point I will say is that this is absolutely not narrowly tailored. It applies to very small groups. It's not a large group event permit. Under any legal test that this court could apply, it's overbroad. The council was referencing zoning districts and the availability of basically opening a soup kitchen on private property as an example of an ample alternative, but we're really talking about the regulation of public forums in this case. And so we have to look at what is available in public parks. And when there's no provisions by which the city ever has to listen or grant a permit, that's inherently inconsistent with a time, place, or manner restriction.
Let me ask you a fact question. In the record, can I tell, if I look in the record, how many people actually gathered on November 6th when the meeting was busted up?
I'm not sure if that's apparent from any of the arrest affidavits. There is some video in the record of several of the arrests.
Would that reveal how many people were there, roughly?
Yes.
And what would it show me? You've seen the video, and the video is in the record. Are we talking to 5, 10, 20, 50, 100, 200, 500, 1,000? Can I discern numbers?
We're probably talking under 50, and that also includes police and members of the media that were present, not just the usual group.
Thank you. You answered my question anyway. Thank you.
Chris Anderson, would you like to wrap up? Because you've gone way over now. Thank you.
Yes, of course. Thank you, Your Honor. One thing I wanted to conclude, which is where Mr. Burke started, which is that all this court has to look at is the first Vagabonds case. And reagree, I think the first Vagabonds case demonstrates why this ordinance is and park rule are unconstitutional. In the Vagabonds case, there were ample alternatives. The permit restriction only applied to a 2-mile radius. It was applied equally to all groups more than 25. And you could still get 2 permits a year in the 2-mile radius. And then it was unlimited in all city parks. There was no restriction. And that is completely different from what we have here. And it was not a discretionary permit scheme. It was ministerial, just as the Supreme Court requires. With that, I respectfully rest on the briefs. And I thank Your Honors for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And thank you, Mr. Burke. We really appreciate your arguments. They were very thoughtful. And we will take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much. Have a good day, both of you.
Thank you, Your Honor.